Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. So we released the April 2025 University of Texas Texas Politics Project poll Wednesday morning, and it is chock full of interesting results to my mind.
Yes.
We might pat ourselves on the back. I think we did a pretty good job here. Now, we'll see. By the time this podcast comes out, we may have been pilloried, but, you know, wouldn't be either the first time nor the last. So, as is general practice, happy to be joined by my colleagues in the Texas Politics Project polling unit today. Darren Shaw, professor of government at the University of Texas, co-founder of the polling project here. Thanks for joining, Darren. Have you turned your grades in yet?
I did about 20 minutes ago. So,
got it.
Man, that feels good.
Got it all wrapped and then came to the podcast.
I'm surprised still in the building.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we'll take credit for that.
Yeah.
And Josh Blank, research director for Same Texas Politics Project, fresh from the real life experience of waiting at the garage for his car to get fixed. How'd that go?
You know, I was working on the poll, so it wasn't that bad. You know, they've got Wi-Fi, coffee. It could have been worse.
Yeah, way to just manage the everyday.
I like to look for gratitude. And what I like to say is when I go to deal with a car for 2 hours and I can like just sit down and do some work, could be worse.
Right. Because, you know.
It could be really disruptive to my life.
Well, yeah, you getting under the car, you have to get out the little thing, then your garage, you can slide under and your wrench set and everything.
How many times do you think I've been under a car other than to like get a ball?
Yeah, well, you know, does college count? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. So as I've said, this poll is really packed with results. Let's start with the basics and with, you know, the center of gravity in the political universe right now. Josh, why don't you give us the kind of methods 411 for the poll, then give us the basics of the Trump results, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, great. So, I mean, the poll was in the field from April 18th to the 28th, and I think it's just important to highlight that for anyone right now looking at any polling stuff. We always say that, you know, polls are snapshots in time, but, like, especially in the moment we're in, I would say even during, you know, as evidenced from the last Trump era, stuff is moving so quickly. We just have to be cognizant of this, right? And so if you had a poll that, let's say, that was in the field before Liberation Day, you might see some slightly different numbers than if you had a poll that was in the field after Liberation Day.
So again, pre-liberation consciousness.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, pre-liberation consciousness. So this was in the field from April 18th to the 28th. As usual, it's 1,200 self-declared registered voters. We collect this data online using YouGov. The overall margin of sampling error for the complete sample is plus or minus 2.83 percentage points, with larger margins of error for subsamples. The overall data is weighted to the joint distribution of gender, age, race, ethnicity, and education to match the registered voter population. So that's the basics. There's a full method statement online and really attached to almost everything, pretty much physical, that you could grab. You mentioned Donald Trump's job approval numbers, or Donald Trump in general. And obviously one of the first things we were interested in is seeing sort of, you know, kind of what has happened since February in a lot of ways. You know, if you remember in the February poll, Donald Trump was polling very well in Texas, 52 approval, 38 disapproval. That was plus 14, which is, I think, one of his best, you know, ratings in the poll. Jump ahead to April. Where are we now? 47% approve, 46% disapprove. So he moves from a plus 14 to a plus 1. His approvals drop by 5. His disapprovals increase by about 8. So that's the top line.
Yeah.
If we want to jump in a little bit to some of the issue areas stuff for a second, I mean, it's hard not to sort of point to the fact that the economy is probably driving some of this drop. So overall, when asked, you know, specifically how Texas voters think Donald Trump is handling the economy, he was underwater. 40% think that he's doing – approve of the job he's doing. 46% disapprove. This is the lowest economic job approval rating that he's seen in our survey. We asked this 5 times between 2019 and 2020. In fact, in October 2020, on the eve of his victory in Texas but ultimate loss, Texas Republicans gave him a 91.6 approval on the economy. Today, only 76% approve of the job he's doing on the economy. So it's certainly not the same environment.
Right. So, Darren, what do you make of this? You've been looking at national polling. You've looked at other, you know, various forms of state polling. You all just did the Lyceum poll a little while ago. Right. But what do you make of what's going on here with Trump in Texas?
Well, I think
in this poll,
in some ways, the analysis I've heard, the chattering you hear online and in the broadcast and cable medium, I think is way too complicated for the storyline here. This is such an example of the Carville maxim, it's the economy, stupid. And, you know, the way in which Trump has sort of dissipated some of that initial, you know, positive sentiment is interesting. And we can talk about that, about, you know, the three kind of main pillars I think we referred to last time, a tariff policy, tax policy, and government spending, reduction in government spending policy. We could talk about the sequencing and the messaging. I don't think this is a case of where the policy itself, with the exception of tariffs, is necessarily unpopular. I think, you know, on government spending, I do think there's an argument that messaging was the problem and kind of the way the rollout was handled. But tariffs, I think, was a mistake. But everything in here, all the macro numbers are derived from the perception that we thought he had a plan. Yeah, I'm not sure he's got a plan. If he's got a plan, I'm not sure it's a good plan. I think is how I would sum up the first 100 days. I was asking Josh off mic before the session, is this just a matter of, you know, essentially Democrats finding a reason to abandon Trump and independents? And Josh, you were saying that just doesn't look to be the case, right? Yeah. That there's some across the board, at least some leakage amongst Republicans.
And that's what I think what it is. And when you look at it, there's no one group. I agree with, I mean, exactly. I mean, when the data came back, the first question when we look at those numbers is, oh, well, this must just be Democrats or independents who, you know, again,
blow with the wind.
Well, they blew with the wind, right? So in October or December, you know, blowing with the wind that was pushing Republicans across the finish line, you know, the sort of, let's say, you know, excitement of the change in February, and now we're kind of just going back to, you know, independents being independents where they don't like anybody. But that's not really the case. You know, and what I'd say is you end up seeing a few point differences everywhere. So you see, you know, approval down by a few points among Democrats, by a few points among independents, by a few points among Republicans. You see disapproval up by a few points among Republicans, just a few, right? We're not talking, there's nobody's running for the exits here, but it goes up a few points among independents, a few more points among Democrats. And it's the sum total of this that I think is attaching this, because I should say, and we can come back to this. I mean, there's a lot of belief among Republicans in the president's agenda in this poll, even if the numbers themselves are, you know, the top line numbers are probably a little bit negative.
Yeah. And Jim, if I could, I've got a,
yeah, please.
You know, we asked a series of questions, and this is, you know, for those of you who are following along at home or want to go look this up on the website, it's sort of a series in the Q19 range. So sort of smack in the middle of the poll after we asked for some of the evaluations of candidates and mood of the country. We asked a series of, you know, approval questions, not just the overall job, but how are you doing on specific issues? And what's interesting to me is that they load into three buckets, and it doesn't take a whole lot of, you know, a whole lot of examination to figure out what those buckets are. At the top end, immigration, border security, president's plus 14. Mm-hmm. On crime and public safety, plus 10. At the bottom end, however, climate change, minus 10, healthcare, minus 10, abortion access, minus 7, right? So pretty negative on those, as one might expect. Then you have this bucket in the middle, government spending, federal workforce, foreign policy, trade, economy, key, and taxes. And they all range from plus 5 to minus 4. Right. So those are, and this is in a Republican state. Mm-hmm. So those are, you know, I think most of them are what we would consider performance issues, right? Especially foreign policy and the economy. And right now he's kind of floundering in those areas, not desperate, but not where he wants to be in a Republican state.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that's interesting about the way that you parse that out, and I kind of did the same thing in my notes when we first got the top line back, you know, when you draw lines about where he's strong, where it's in the middle, that middle range that you, and then where it's bad, but that middle range you start, are areas that you would think are areas of strength for him. And I haven't gone back and looked, and maybe you have, Josh, but I think in our last issue battery, which was done slightly differently, the issue battery of the last Trump presidency, you know, he tended to be in positive territory, I think, on most of the issues.
I think that's right. I mean, just, I want to point to something real quick and then come back, because I think Darren said something which is in a Republican-leaning state, and I think for people listening to this, it's important to point out there are more Republicans in the sample than there are Democrats. There's a clear Republican advantage in the registered voter sample. So if anyone were to look at this and say, well, clearly there's just too many Democrats, like, no, there are more Republicans than Democrats. To your point, I think, you know, I mean, I think this is always the sort of thing. I mean, one, we're trying to figure out what is the relevant point of comparison here, right? And I think your first point is, you know, one, how does this look to his compared to his first term? And I think one of the interesting things to me right now, and I think, look, I don't think you can just make an apples to apples comparison, because we're going to hold, you know, ceteris paribus. There's a million things we're holding constant here. But at the same time, it's really easy to kind of look back and say, boy, you know, his economy numbers were higher like during the pandemic than they are right now. And another point of comparison, I was just looking back at this because I thought this was interesting. You know, we were giving Joe Biden so much crap here, right? In particular, because he was running well with Democrats. And if we look back to April of last year and we look at Democratic approval of Joe Biden on the economy, very, you know, strong approval, 35, somewhat approved, 37. And we look at Republicans towards Trump a year later in April, 25, strong approval 43, so higher, somewhat approved 33. So not like dramatically different numbers within their partisans.
Yeah, that's the important thing.
And so I think, you know, one of the things that I'm seeing, you know, sort of overall, but it's not something that I think you see as like a big kind of central tendency, because it's not the central tendency. The central tendency is support. And I think there's just, you can't deny that. And anyone who sort of looks around and forgets the fact that Texas is a Republican state, there's a ton of support for his immigration efforts, which I think is a big, you know, he has a lot of rope here between, you know, the immigration issue and even some of the stuff on tariffs and government spending and government efficiency and all of that kind of stuff. He has a fair amount of room here. But, you know, what you do see throughout all this is there is a sort of a small but nonetheless significant minority who are kind of looking out saying, yeah, I don't know about this, more so than we saw last time. You don't see that overwhelming where you get to 91% of Republicans saying he's doing great on the economy. It's like, well, it's 76 right now.
I want to connect a couple other corners of the triangle to that. And that is, let's start with tariffs, just because that's so close to this economic reading. And clearly, in terms of kind of the portrait that you're beginning to paint here, Darren, in terms of he's struggling a little bit, that, you know, your kind of anecdotal description, which I really liked in the beginning, of people kind of going, well, I don't know. What does he seem to know? What's, you know, I'm not sure what he's doing here, kind of thing. Right. And that say a lot of things about Donald Trump, but a lot of his followers, I think, didn't used to really say that much. He did it. And that's, we seem to have, like, are we reaching a limit on that? And is tariffs what's driving that? Are tariffs what's driving that?
Yeah, we talked a lot last year about how retrospective evaluations of Trump's economy were very, very positive.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you ask people to fill in some specifics for, well, why was that the case? You know, why did you approve of Trump's handling? He, you know, people would basically say, like, well, the economy was good. you know, it wasn't that they'd point to the 2017 Trump tax cuts.
Right.
Or, you know, some people did. Some people pointed to COVID relief or things like that. But it was largely, well, stock market's going good. He seems to have cut regulations and taxes. This is sort of the standard bucket of Republican.
Right. And compared to my more recent memories, we weren't talking about prices.
Right. Exactly.
Also, you know, I mean, just to throw this out there, I mean, I think the nature of the problems he faced were such that some of, and I'm just thinking, this is actually like a sort of a deep psychological kind of how people process these things. But you wonder how much, you know, people are reacting to an actual evaluation, some kind of like a full-formed evaluation of the economy versus reacting to the Delta. Right. So the economy was doing well, but then the pandemic hit and now everything is like terrible. So like the Delta. Yeah, you're welcome. The Delta is actually the thing that you're evaluating. And yeah, things were so much better before this pandemic hit. Now, does that mean it was like great relative to like something, you know, again, throw that out there.
I think that's right. But, you know, Jim, you asked about tariffs. And I think there's two things. First of all, in that that battery of questions about Trump handling different issues. The one that is, it's a performance issue that is not kind of in the middle, is prices and inflation.
Yeah.
He's down, he's underwater by 14 points, I believe.
That's correct.
Which is, you know, it's not Biden territory where Biden was under by 20 to 30 points on that, but it's not good.
And it's not Trump territory.
Right. That's right.
On most things economic.
So I think one of the things I'm looking at, one of the things I'm looking at in this poll is, you know, look, if people are going to evaluate the economy based on prices and based on tariffs, I'm not sure you could have more unfavorable terms currently for Trump. And it's dragging the other stuff around. Like, he's a little underwater on taxes. He's a little underwater on Doge and some stuff like that. And I think you could make an argument that he's kind of lost some ground on the messaging on government efficiency. But if I'm in the Trump administration, I would much rather have a fight about, you know, waste, government inefficiency, and fraud, and on the nature of tax reform than I would on, you know, getting my Cheerios back down under $8 a box and defending, you know, tariffs. And some of these are obviously self-inflicted.
I think on the Doge kind of government efficiency thing, in retrospect, we're going to look back and think you got a lot of media attention and he had that, you know, the sort of attraction, whatever was going on with Elon Musk. In the end, that diluted the message that would have been better for them, I think, pretty substantially.
It was interesting, not to get too much into anecdotes, but I was watching Bret Baier on Fox News had a forum with all these Doge people were out there. And these were, you know, businessmen, you know, entrepreneurs, corporation owners in their 40s and 50s in suits, talking about how they'd taken leave to participate in this action. And I thought, this shouldn't be 3.5 to 4 weeks in. This should have been what you led with. I think at that point they were doing damage control because the image was a bunch of, you know, 20 somethings at best
being led by Elon Musk, working out of
mom's basement, who were, you know, just going through people's personal records. And I did think, you know, to be serious, to have blown that issue, and I think there's a compelling argument they blew that issue, is possibly the largest failing. I mean, we could talk about sort of tariffs versus that, but if the economy is your focal point and you lost people on curbing government inefficiency, that's a pretty big L early on.
Especially an issue that's a Republican you should own. I mean, just straight up.
Right.
Like, you know, this shouldn't be a difficult task.
Yeah. And I don't want to be too, look, you know, we can make, you know, we can have an interesting conversation about, you know, media antipathy and media, and I'll say this, for some reason, focusing on a single government worker in Arlington who lost his job, as opposed to some of the billions of dollars that were pretty clearly revealed to be, shall we say, misspent. But that only goes so far, right? That you know, media hostility is to blame for all this. I don't buy that. I think it's, you know, kind of, there's a little more self blame than probably the Trump administration wants to admit. But the other side of that, so that's the Doe stuff, but the tariff stuff, which Jim asked about, I think about 10 minutes ago, is clearly unpopular.
Talk to us about those tariff numbers a little bit, Josh.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, because it's not just that it's unpopular; it's the mixture of present and future expectations and how things kind of play out.
It's deeper than you might think, issue that's complicated. Right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we look at is, you know, we asked at least two questions both in February and again in April, and part of that is to see, you know, again, whether there's been an effect of the coverage, whether people have learned more about it. I mean, people are paying a ton of attention to it. When we asked them the news battery, you know, what have you heard a lot about? Increased tariffs was at the top of the list. I think 70% of Texans said they'd heard a lot about it, you know, blew everything else almost out of the water. So it is on people's minds. Nonetheless, the attitudes between February and now didn't move a ton. And really, the only one that I saw move kind of really noticeably was there's a slight uptick in Republicans' view that in the long run, it's going to be worth it, which actually shows where the messaging is working here. And so what we see is, you know, we added a question in particular about whether or not people think that tariffs will help them and their family, hurt them and their family, or have no impact. Majority of Texans, 53%, think it's going to hurt their family. 70% of Texans think it's going to lead to higher prices. And 46% think it's going to hurt the economy in the long run. But this is where the biggest split is. 39% think it's going to help the economy in the long run, including 72% of Republicans. Among those Republicans, 50% acknowledge that there's going to be higher prices. But 40% think, nonetheless, that it is going to help them and their family. Now, that all sounds pretty confusing, and I think ultimately you kind of need to – there needs to be some – we need to do a little more deeper analysis here. But one of the things that I noticed in the open-endeds, you know, and I think part of this is just thinking about the messaging here, and we've talked about this a lot, right? You know, if you're someone who follows this stuff closely and you're listening to the arguments of economists, you know, you have one view of this. But there are other views of this which are just simply, you know, I think what people put together, which is to say, you know, if we stop buying stuff from other countries and start buying it here, it'll get cheaper, right? And actually, that's kind of what you saw in some of the open-ended. So as I was coding the open-ended for what the legislature should do, it was interesting the number of sort of – and again, when you say like the number, I mean, you know, when you're looking for patterns, you notice something when it comes up 3 or 5 times, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But these things come up where people would put in, you know, we need to implement the tariffs so we can lower prices. And so I think the thing is I think one of the things that we all need to be a little bit humble about here, you know, is we're not necessarily looking at this from, you know, again, a shared understanding of sort of the way these things work. I mean, if you think about even from a public opinion standpoint, starting this thing, boy, can we even ask people what they think about tariffs? Because we don't really know if they know what they are yet.
Well, you know, you and I have talked about that. I think it came up maybe in the podcast before, I mean, but it's really clear in this poll, it's striking, and this is like an old guy thing, but how two of the driving economic concepts right now, inflation, rising prices, and tariffs. 18 months ago would have seemed, or maybe not, well, not inflation 18 months ago, but a few years ago would have seemed like just anachronistic concerns. But the upshot of that is that we've got, you know, figure it out, at least two generations of people that have no direct experience in any significant way with inflation.
Right.
And probably, you know, other than depending on, you know, on your membership in a relatively narrow sector of the economy, you know, when was the last time you were at a dinner party and somebody brought up tariffs, even if it was a Brainiac dinner party?
Well, Smoot Hawley, but
yeah, right, exactly.
It's always a toe tapper.
Let's have a big discussion of Smoot Hawley. Could you hand me that Beaujolais?
Yeah, and a hammer to beat my brain in. no, you know, I found, yeah, every now and then we spend a lot of time talking about how we think about politics and we're digesting information, getting all this stuff, but most people aren't, you know. On the other hand, occasionally you'll see an issue where you think it's too complex, but I've actually been impressed by early on. Josh mentioned there hasn't been a lot of movement. That's because in the initial polls, you know, our respondents seem pretty capable of digesting and then, you know, kind of giving us back the main criticisms of tariffs, which is, you know, we ask people two questions that kind of encapsulate two different aspects of tariffs. The first is this going to result in increased prices for the American consumer? And most people say yes. I mean, it's fairly overwhelming. And it's split on, I guess, the paired question of, will it help protect U.S. jobs? And that's where, you know, it really kind of breaks down. We didn't do this on this survey, but we have in the past. I'd add another level of complexity, which is, it depends on which country you're talking about. What we've seen in the national polling is that appetite for tariffs on Canada is basically non-existent. A little more so on Mexico, and then huge support for tariffs on China.
Right.
And so, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, the lack of engagement of the American public. And I think that's true. There's all sorts of reasons for that, but I think that's true. But occasionally you come into this stuff, and Josh used the word humbled, and I think that's right. I'm actually kind of impressed by the public's takeaway points from this, what I thought would be a really esoteric discussion of tariffs and things like that.
Well, I think part of that is that the messaging from the Trump administration has been pretty powerful on this and is tapping into those kinds of dispositions among their base. I mean, I think pretty directly.
Yeah. Right? And I think they have to.
I mean, I think that's the interesting part here. There's sort of there's a couple of things going on here, but at least two kind of worthwhile to identify. Like, there's the reality that which people are experiencing this, and then there's politics that are overlaying it, right? And one of the other pieces of this poll that, you know, it almost gets buried in it, but it's really interesting, is that, you know, even though people's economic concerns are ever present, you know, we have a majority Republican, you know, sample giving net negative economic numbers. But what we also saw was concern about prices. The share of people who said they were extremely concerned about the price of everyday consumer goods went down.
Yeah.
Now, why does it go down, right, given all this talk about prices? And I think part of that is the political overlay here. You know, to the extent the Democrats have been essentially running around now for 2.5 months yelling that the president is going to, you know, essentially drive prices through the roofs,
right.
Well, if they haven't driven through the roof at a certain point, and especially if your partisan disposition goes in the other direction, you know, you're going to say, there they go again, right? The sky is falling, but it's not. Clearly, this is a thing. And actually, you can see some people reconsidering their concern about prices. The only problem here, and I think, you know, so that's the politics side of this, but then there's the reality side of this, which is, you know, and we don't really define this in this poll, but, you know, what is in the short run? What is in the long run, right? So, you know, even though everybody expects prices to go up in the short run, and that's a price that at least Republicans feel like they're willing to pay for the long-term gain, and that they think that even personally that's going to benefit them. And really, they're the only ones I can see in any polling who say with any great certainty that they're going to benefit from increasing tariffs. But the question to my mind is, like, when does that have to happen by? Does it have to happen before 2026?
Well,
does it have to happen before 2028?
Right. It wasn't. You know, we paid pretty close attention to what the presidential candidates were saying, and there was not consistent messaging that if you elect me, you know, things are going to get tough for a little while, but then they'll get better. I don't recall that ad.
We're going to have an adult conversation, everybody, right. American people.
But what's interesting is that Republicans seem to be kind of accepting that message. So I'm looking at we ask a question about the nature of the expectations about the national economy. And in December, after the election of Trump, we asked, you know, things going to get better or worse? Going to stay about the same. 52% said things were going to get better. 23% said worse. Now that went to 49% better, 31% worse in February. Now it's 42% better, 35% worse. So it's you're still plus 7 better to worse, but you know the 10-point drop in the percentage of people who said they're going to be better off in a year, you know, speaks to a little two things, right? The erosion of confidence in the administration's policies, but perhaps, you know, maybe equally important is a resetting of expectations.
Well, the message, the administration's messaging is landing. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say that, you know, this is not my role usually, but, you know, there's a political science moment here, right? In that, you know, as I was saying a little while ago, a lot of people didn't really probably have a lot of pre-fashioned attitudes about tariffs. The initial discussion's pretty complex. But now the modal Republican position does seem to be very close to what the Trump administration wants it to be, at least for now, which is short-term pain, long-term prosperity.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the question, I think, you know, with all – I mean, like, this is so complicated. I mean, I think it's interesting to think about how that overlays with, you know, both sort of – I'll say it this way. The Trump's coalition in 2024, the likely Republican coalition in 2026, and the potential Republican coalition in 2028. Because it's one thing if you're committed to these ideas and you've been committed to these ideas. You know, you've been a Republican for years, and the idea of ferreting out, you know, government inefficiency and, you know, sort of the malfeasance of China and these other countries is sort of part of your, you know, your overall political worldview. You know, you probably have a fair amount of you know, tolerance for the pain. You know, I think about, you know, what we were talking about this election, the idea of, you know, Trump's sort of working class coalition who really does not have the slack to pick up, you know, much of any sort of pain. And, you know, and ultimately, you know, that's a lot to ask for people who are sort of being, you know, sort of committed to either a person, an ideology, a party, what at this point? I'm not really sure exactly. Yeah. So it's sort of, it's an open question.
Well, I think.
Given the margins that we see.
The pessimistic view, I'd double down on what Josh is saying here. We asked these trait questions, you know, and compared them to October 24 in the smack dab in the middle of the campaign. And the one that I would be concerned about if I'm with the Trump team is the empathy question. Cares about people like you. Republicans generally don't do well on empathy. And Donald Trump, you know, and say what you like, he does very well in strong leader and these sorts of characteristics. He does less well on empathy.
Empathy is not really a brand trait.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But he was, you know, about even. Minus two, 46 yes, 48 no on whether, you know, cares about people like me describes Donald Trump. Well, it's now 40% yes, 51% no.
Do you know where the biggest drop was?
Which one?
With that one, Hispanics. Yeah. Among cares about people like me. Between those two, a 10-point drop.
This one would really concern me if I were in the administration because, you know, to what you guys are talking about, you know, these are economic evaluations, but with far-reaching political implications. And the notion was is that Trump understands that prices affect people like me. He gets it. Biden and these Democrats, they're just, you know, they don't care. They're a bunch of elites and, you know, they didn't even acknowledge inflation for a while. Okay, but a couple months in, you know, if the prices remain high and the rhetoric is, oh, well, you know, you're going to have to tough it out, where are we? And this speaks to this long conversation about realignments and working class voters and Hispanics. Mm-hmm. So stuff is, you know, shockingly interconnected.
Well, it's also, it's an interesting comment too, or, you know, it kind of diverts attention in an interesting way to how tapped into this, for better or for worse, Trump can sometimes seem, right? In terms of, you know, the much publicized excerpt from an interview he gave over the weekend in which he was talking about the degree to which, you know, the economy, the money quote was the good parts of the economy are the Trump economy and the bad parts of the economy are the Biden economy. And I get the instinct, and it shows that he recognizes what he's up against. I don't think that dog's going to hunt, but it's it was an interesting moment that crystallizes some of that. Let's pivot while we have time. There's a lot of things we could come back into here, and maybe we'll get it in some of the dealer's choice. But a lot of talk in Texas right now, and in selected circles, though not clearly the general electorate, about 2026. Focal point in Texas right now, the U.S. Senate race, John Cornyn running for re-election, facing a challenge from at least Ken Paxton so far, a couple other names kind of being mentioned out there. So, Darren, what do you make of where this stands based on what we're seeing in the poll and then, you know, the gossip-rich environment that's out there around this race right now? That gives you a lot of room to say or not say.
Well, right? I'll begin with the mundane for people who have been longtime listeners to this podcast, and that is that we continue to be shocked is probably too strong a word, but the mediocre numbers that John Cornyn has overall, and I would consider at this point, I can't think of another word other than troubling numbers amongst Republicans compared to either the more conservative crowd like Ted Cruz or the more MAGA-inclined crowd, like I'll just say Paxton for present purposes, right?
That gets you to where we need to go pretty quickly.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, it's even at his height, and if you look at, you know, Cornyn's numbers in this particular poll, they're not especially, you know, worse. They're not, you know, better than he typically
in
does.
In line.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he is minus 14. Approve, disapprove. And this is as his job as a U.S. Senator. So he's 27 approve, 41 disapprove. Now, that's a chunk of people in the middle. There's always about 20% in the middle who just say they neither approve nor disapprove. And another 10% who say they don't know.
But that in itself is telling for a guy who's been a U.S. Senator.
Right. One third basically do not have an opinion about Cornyn's performance in the Senate. And the 27% approve is pretty bad. You know, just sort of looking back, he hasn't been that low since June of 2022. Now, at that point, he had kind of a low watermark, 24% approve, 50% disapprove, right? So he's not there. But boy, you know, that is a tough number in a Republican state.
I think that was in the wake of the Sutherland Springs and sort of the passage of the gun reform.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that dip.
Living that down.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'd say that dip was actually drop in Republican support. Yeah.
Right. But if you go back to 2024, he was minus 5, minus 2, minus 6, minus 4, plus 1. Minus 1, plus 1, minus 7, and now minus 11. So the trend line is not in the
right
direction.
I have jumped up and down and been happy to jump into the damning Cornyn with faint praise argument that we've done so many times on the podcast. But but here's the rub, right? The other point is, here's a guy that's not lost an election in
exactly
his career, to
exactly
my knowledge.
Exactly. And, you know, if we were talking about this in the context of a general election, I think we'd say, yeah, that's interesting, but he's still going to whack whoever it is he runs against, which I think is my opinion if he wins the nomination. But has he ever faced a real strong primary
And Paxton's
challenge?
Numbers are significantly better.
Right. Now, Paxton right now, you know, just to take the same time frame, so if we take all our 2024 data, he's plus 4, plus 6, minus 2, minus 5, right, even, plus 10 in October 2024, plus 3, and now he's minus 5. So, you know, we don't want to lump all this on Cornyn. There's been a general reduction in Republican ratings as they've owned the keys to the car, both at the state and national level. So that's
and Paxton's numbers have been particularly subject to shifts given, you know, the unpleasantness surrounding him periodically.
Right. And if you look at the strongly disapproved numbers, you know, Paxton is at 30% strongly disapproved, Cornyn at 27. But where you see a difference is strongly approved 13% Paxton, 8%. Now you could say, like, well, that's not very much. But if you take the Republican segment of the electorate, that's where you just get this intense support.
Right. Why don't you give us the direct comparison, if you can, Josh, among Republicans, Paxton and Cornyn right now.
Yeah, right now among Republicans. So for Cornyn, he is at, let's see. So among Republicans, he is above water. So there's that. 44-26, so plus 18. Among conservatives, he's 40-31, so only plus 9. If we go to Paxton, let's see one more. Here we go. we go to Paxson, we see among Republicans, he's 60-13, so plus 47. Among conservatives, 59-14, so plus 45. So he's a little bit of a bump. I mean, another way to look at it is the favorability numbers, too, which is more general outside of job approval or any of that kind of stuff. Among Republicans, Cornyn is 46 favorable, 22 unfavorable. Paxson is 59-11. For point of comparison, Donald Trump is 89-6. Elon Musk is 89 among Republicans.
Yeah.
Now, we'll say, you know, you were bringing up these job provisions. And one of the interesting things about Cornyn, and I think, you know, there's sort of a couple things, and I'll just sort of put this out there and you guys can jump on it. I mean, there's a sort of question about, you know, I mean, I think the numbers in and of themselves should explain to anyone why there are people interested in running against him in a primary, because there's a wellspring of, you know, sort of negative attitudes among Republican voters that any primary challenger could at least try to mobilize, right? And so, I mean, the real question, you know, I think for Cornyn, obviously, is sort of who's going to be in that Republican primary and can he escape it, right? Or can they split the votes or whatever? Is there some way he can work his way around that? But the other interesting thing I was noticing looking at those trends, and this is just sort of a reminder here, and this is what the other discussion that's going on right now about, like, let's say Paxson were in the race, there's, you know, I think Republican, you know, there's certain types of Republicans right now who are releasing or leaking polls that show, you know, like Paxton losing to Colin Allred and stuff like that for whatever, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Which also means about nothing right now. But one of the things I noticed looking at that trend is if you look at Cornyn's job approval among Republicans just over time, and we've got like, you know, 30 of these or whatever. But if you look on the eve of the elections, right? So you go back to, you know, October 2020, 71% approval among Republicans, right? You go up to, and you sort of each, I'm sorry, just looking back, basically, each sort of time he actually comes up for election, you see his approval numbers jump up. And this is the thing about Cornyn in particular, if you watch him every year, it's sort of like, and it's sort of, it's funny. On the one hand, everybody's kind of like attaching to the Paxson, like, oh, he's getting all nasty. And it's like, yeah, but like he always gets a little bit punchy as the election cycle comes around. His social media ramps up. You start to see, and I say, like, and I'm not to being, you know.
He gets more combative and more attentive to the right.
Yeah, and I would say, this is exactly right. It's not to damn him again with faint praise again. It's like he starts to sound more like what Texas Republicans currently sound like than he does kind of once he gets back into office and sort of goes into the leadership role, which is part of the criticism. Yeah. But it doesn't mean he doesn't know how to do it.
Look, we'll talk about this race ad nauseum, I think.
Yes.
But it shapes up. You understand why Paxton is people be enthused or enticed about getting into this race. I completely agree that, you know, Cornyn has a sort of old school appeal. He looks like a senator. He's never lost an election.
And he looks like a senator from the 70s.
Yeah, exactly. And to be fair, if you look at his record, it's unclear exactly what conservatives are angry about. You know, I there's just something about him maybe that seems like he's a part of the club, which I think he is. And I think that's an argument in his favor in a lot of ways, that he seems to be pretty effective at what he does. He's held these leadership positions, but it just never really resonated the way, you know, like a Ted Cruz did, or even oddly enough, a Paxton. That's not predictive. There's a long way to go. But I think what's happening now is that in a primary, let's assume traditionally a relatively low turnout primary, where there are potentially incentives for Democrats and independents to cross over to, shall we say, voice their opinion to create a weaker candidate. By the way, that never seems to happen, but it's certainly a possibility. You could see where Jim and I were kind of alluding to this earlier, that look, there. I think if I were Cornyn, I'd have a two-pronged strategy. One would be really to try to get another MAGA candidate in the race, just to split the Paxton vote. Because Paxton, for all his support amongst the MAGA crowd, is a pretty flawed candidate. You know, he's never really had, you know, people talk about Cornyn in the context of a primary, and I completely acknowledge that a primary dominated by MAGA and conservative Republicans is going to be a little tricky for him against a, you know, kind of a hero of the MAGA movement. On the other hand, Paxton's never run in a serious primary like this, where someone...
Well, yeah, he had a pretty tough primary. I mean, he was challenged last time.
Yeah.
But I think
you know, that's different than a $45 million bank account
Senate race. Being challenged for attorney general and being challenged for a U.S. Senate with federal limitations is a big difference.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing here. I mean, I think it's really easy, you know, again, for this audience who's paid attention to this for a while, it's really easy to look at them and say, okay, baseline, you know, Cornyn's not as strong as some other people are. There's an obvious reason for Paxton getting in. I think something you pointed out that I want to just point out for our listeners here, you know, Paxton's money doesn't transfer to the federal race. It hasn't been raised through the same campaign finance law. So he's starting to some extent from scratch. Cornyn is not. The other thing is, I think, that differentiates Cornyn from Eva Guzman or George P. Bush in that last primary is the fact that both of those candidates were a little bit reluctant to go negative. As negative as I think some people thought they might on Paxson given the situation, because the politics in that moment were a little unclear in terms of where people wanted to position themselves around the impeachment, around what the issues were around the impeachment. Cornyn has no such qualms, obviously, in bringing up all of this stuff. And I think one of the things that we talked about a lot during the impeachment trial with Paxson was the fact that while there were a lot of people spending money on Paxson's behalf to reach out to those kinds of voters to put that message out that, in fact, he was being railroaded, there was no similar, you know, sort of spending effort on the other side.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, Paxson hasn't really faced the, I mean, just Darren's point, I guess, he faced two good challengers, but he hasn't faced the kind of heat he's going to face in this race and the kind of scrutiny that I think someone like Cornyn is going to turn on.
Well, and I wouldn't want to go too far with this because context was important.
Totally.
But in 2018, that was the race Justin Nelson ran in the general against Paxton.
Right.
And, you know, look, 2018 was a very good Democratic year, so I don't want to, you know, we can't overvalue that. But it's not irrelevant, and certainly Justin Nelson would tell you this, that, you know, his theory of the case all along was that Paxton's ethics made him vulnerable and that a Democrat who ran hard and was aggressive on that had a real shot, and he came within 3-4 points, as I recall. And so,
I think
the Cornyn people are sending clear messages around town, and you're already seeing it in social media, but they are letting everybody that will listen know, near as I can tell, exactly what Darren is saying. We are going to, you know, we are not going to, you know, there's going to be no punches pulled here.
Yeah.
This is going to, nothing will be off the table, and we got a lot to put on the table here.
Right. I think, you know, we're talking about the sort of preliminary baseline data, and our message simply is, yeah, we get it. We get why a longstanding senator might, in, you know, might produce a challenge, despite, you know, people looking at the at this from the outside thinking, like, why is there anything like this? But I also think we have a strong suspicion that, you know, look, Cornyn is going to embrace Trump. He's going to embrace his conservative record, which is pretty formidable. And I don't know, just sort of sitting here way too far out, but this is not a Democrat simply trying to exploit Paxton's ethics issues. This is a Republican who can say, give me an issue where he and I are different, and if you can, great, but let me throw on the case, I've not been impeached.
Right, you should also, right? Yes.
Right, exactly.
By the way, I was in that office. I never had any of these problems.
And look, the impeachment is the least of it, actually.
Right, right. No, that's right.
I think they will not mention the impeachment. They will mention all the stuff that came up
impeachment. No, you're dead on, Jim. But one final thing. Allow me to telescope out for a second right now, because we were talking about battleground races in 2026 in the Senate. And, you know, recall the Democrats need to flip 3 seats. So on the Democratic side, you have an open seat in Minnesota where the Democrat is stepping down. Ossoff running in Georgia, which is going to be would have been an extremely tough race had Kemp decided to run. But now, I think
they've dodged the bullet on that.
Yeah, I think it still could be a tough race, but I think he's now a nominal favorite. Tina Smith stepping down in Minnesota, so an open seat in Minnesota, which is Democratic-leaning. Shaheen not running in New Hampshire. So four seats on the Dem side. So you got to hold all those seats and pick up 3. There's Maine, where the Republicans are defending, okay, with Susan Collins. There's North Carolina. So those are 2 possibilities, although I think, you know, if we had a dollar for every time someone tried to knock off Collins in Maine.
Yeah.
But that means the Democrats are short at least 1, even if they hold all their seats. And so what's fascinating about the Texas situation is, I'll just sort of submit this, and I'm happy to be disproven, Texas is not on the target list unless Cornyn loses the primary.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If he does lose and Paxton's a candidate, then I would jump Texas as basically the third state into a trifecta. And the slight complication, not going too far afield, is whether Sherrod Brown would decide to run in Ohio.
Yeah.
Right? Because those are the 4 states, right? Maine, North Carolina, Ohio, and Texas that might be on the Democrats. They need to win 3 of those 4 and hold.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it'll be interesting. This is, of course, a Texas podcast, and we run a Texas poll. But the national implications are really pretty significant here.
Well, and I think it's worth mentioning, because I think what it also means is that the incentives for P- people getting involved in this are really high on both sides, and we're seeing that.
Right.
Right. We're seeing the discussion. I mean, I think it's a little quieter on the Democratic side, but it's definitely going on.
You're going to see some interesting contribution.
I think that's right. On the Republican side, to go back to, you know, something you kind of gingerly raised before, but that I'm going to air out a little more anyway, is that, you know, the maneuvering going on between around who gets in that race on the Republican side between now and December, when the actual deadline is just going to it's rampant right now, and it's going to keep going on. There are non-intuitive kind of alliance things lining up in the funding universe in this Paxton and Cornyn race that I think have not quite made it into print yet, but that are out there and very interesting. And part of that, you know, you mentioned, you know, trying to bring a MAGA person in to split the vote. It's not only to split the vote, it's to confound the issue of the Trump endorsement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. I agree with that.
I think that Trump endorsement, you know, who knows? I mean, given what we were saying earlier, maybe that's not as valuable a year from now as it is now, but it's not going to be valueless. It's still probably going to be pretty valuable in a Republican primary. And that is a, you know, there are a lot of potential entrants who in the state who have ambitions and egos and who could be convinced to get in this race, even if it's not in their best interest.
Very gingerly put, I would say.
Well,
I didn't
even mention any names. Yeah. So, you know, give me something for that to help you out. All right. We're getting pretty close. Let's do our dealer's choice right now. So talk about something in the poll we haven't talked about that interested you. Josh, why don't you start?
Yeah, you know, I mean, obviously there's a ton of stuff in this survey that's looking at the legislature and what the legislature's up to. I mean, when I say ton, I mean, I'm not even joking. There's so much stuff that we haven't talked about that is in this poll, because we've really focused on the national stuff, and the national implications in some ways certainly affect what's going on in Texas. But I should say we have a lot of items on the strictness of state laws, on spending, on policy priorities, on particular policies, on public ed and vouchers. So there's just a lot of stuff in here, even more that I, you know, can't even talk about. So let me say this, though. I mean, what really stuck out to me was, you know, we did a little policy battery, support, oppose, 12 policies being considered in front of the legislature. And one of the interesting things that sort of came out of that battery to my mind was really one of the first instances in which I've seen, I think, I'm not going to call it some movement, but maybe some consequence to the major shift in the state's abortion laws. You know, one of the things about abortion attitudes is they tend to be pretty static, pretty consistent, because most people, you know, they're supported by, you know, a number of different considerations and elements. They don't get moved a ton. What we found in this poll that was pretty interesting was that when we asked about these policy proposals, the proposal that got the most support overall was clarifying when doctors in Texas can perform a legal abortion if a woman's life is at risk. 76% said they supported this, 13% opposed it. This was more than any other issue. It included 71% of independents, 81% of Republicans, and 91% of Democrats. Through the, you know, at the bottom of the list, interestingly enough, was actually the sort of twin proposals to give individuals additional rights to sort of use the civil enforcement mechanism, or the quote unquote bounty hunter mechanism, essentially to sue in one item people or entities that they believe have helped someone obtain abortion pills, and another, sue people or entities that they believe have helped someone travel out of Texas to obtain a legal abortion. In both of those cases, majorities of voters were opposed, 54% against giving people more rights to sue people who helped others get abortion pills, 58% against the travel thing. The travel thing is always a little bit less popular, you know, freedom of movement. Only 28 and 25% supported these. Interestingly enough, and I'll get out of this quickly enough here, you know, the splits by party were interesting. So, you know, while about 3/4 of Democrats were opposed to both sort of, you know, more suing mechanisms for pills and travel, for Republicans, it depended on the issue. 40% were supportive of giving people additional rights to sue people, basically to stop them from getting abortion pills. 37% were opposed, almost an even split on pills. On travel, 44% opposed, 34% in support. This is, to me, just, you know, looking at a lot of abortion numbers over time, to see the way that these results, again, sort of split to the top and the bottom, and also the partisan splits in these numbers. I mean, I think this, to me, is the first set of results where I'd say now we're in the next kind of era in some ways, where they're actually dealing with the actual status quo of the state and the laws exist, and people are reacting to that status quo, and we're starting to actually see that in the polling data.
And the way that's manifesting on the ground in the legislature is really fascinating right now, because you're seeing momentum for the passage of, you know, the bill that would clarify,
right,
you know, the treatment conditions, et cetera, right, that you were talking about. But also, you know, the attempt to move some of the other restrictions on abortion pills. I mean, and so you've got this kind of dual movement as, you know, the legislature tries to find the right position to govern from, with their eye on both a tough general election year potentially, right, given the timing of the cycle, but also, you know, probably a pretty ramped up primary season, in part because of that Cornyn Paxton race.
Yeah.
Right. So you were saying it's a low turnout race, Darren, and I agree with that on the scale of things.
Right.
But relative, you know, but there's probably going to be a bit of interest in that race.
Oh, yeah.
And some turnout race. So what did you actually, if you want to comment on that and then give us your
oh, yeah,
dealer's
sure.
choice?
Yeah, low turnout's always a relative thing. This is in, you know, compared to general elections in Texas, primary turnout's just dismal.
Yeah.
But compared to past midterm primary elections, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
And that's going to be one of the big, you know, one of the big questions going into it. I love this battery that Jim and Josh put together. If you're looking online, it's in this Q32. So it's towards the back end of the polls. All these different positions that are, you know, sort of being codified in actual legislation that's either pending or at least has been talked about pending in front of the House. And so this stuff is really interesting. You know, Josh talked about the abortion stuff. I'm not going pot. I'll leave that to Jim. he can talk about cannabis or betting. You know, I'm not airing Jim's you know, dirty laundry here. My eye went actually to banning the use of cell phones in K-12 public schools during school hours. I was actually listening to a radio show this weekend. They were had an expert on who was talking about Arkansas data, that Arkansas is one of the states that has already passed this law, and how initial kind of returns, both in terms of public opinion and in some very, very preliminary scores, indicate that this is doing pretty well. That it, and parents seem to really like it. We didn't have a marital status parents with kids. Oh, actually, we do in the back end.
Yeah, we can look it up later.
Yeah, so we can look that up later. Or, you know, I encourage listeners to go knock themselves out and take a look at that.
Yeah, grab the data; it's there.
Yeah, but we're 66% of the Texas RV population approves or supports banning these cell phones K through 12. Public schools during school hours, 25% opposed. So, you know, a quarter say no, two-thirds say yes.
77% of Republicans.
It is, you know, and I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, there was an accompanying article that I read this last weekend after I heard this report from Arkansas about twin screening. And just the, you know, we think that young people are really good at this. I know my young people, my three kids, all think they're really good at this. There's almost zero empirical data to support the notion that, you know, twin screening is an effective way to absorb information from either of the
Multitasking
screens.
Is a myth, everybody.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna tell you right now, it's not how the brain works.
Yeah, and I took this as kind of the edge of the spear when it comes to the role of technology in the classroom. And you know, maybe a little bit of a retrenchment from just what I experienced when my kids were in the public schools over in Eanes, which was, you know, immediately, as soon as tablets became available, you know, the school system said, let's give everybody tablets and we'll have controls on them so our kids will not be able to access dangerous websites, which it took them, as far as I could see, about 15 minutes to get around.
And then it took, one semester. And now you can opt into the class with no tablets.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so this is interesting. I think it represents kind of a larger recalibration of, you know, what's effective. How is the technology, which, you know, to be fair and to not be quite as jokey about it, but, you know, a lot of us thought about how democratizing both the internet and, you know, broadband access would be with respect to information. People could get information and process it in a way they'd never done before, and information that had only been available to academics and eggheads was going to be available to everybody at the touch of a screen. I think that's still true, but I think the downside, which some people probably saw but maybe we didn't appreciate enough, is just information overload and the difficulty in culling information and figuring out what's worth reading and what's not, and how, you know, the divided attention can compromise, you know, our ability to teach our kids. And I think this is a response to declining test scores, right? And what people see on the ground and in their homes.
I mean, the only thing I just want to say about this is I think this is a really interesting result, and not because I think it's necessarily counterintuitive, but just because this is one of those things where I had no idea going into this what the distribution of this would be. I mean, to follow, I think, popular coverage right now, there's a big, you know, obviously push towards sort of removing these technologies and especially social media from, you know, at least people below a certain age. But at the same time, I think in the fairness, in the desire for fairness of coverage, it almost feels like everything I've read, it will find at least a few parents, I mean, we'll actually almost prioritize the views of a few parents who say, no, I need to be able to reach my kid during the school day. What if? And I think, you know, listening to that coverage, I mean, I was sort of struggling with, what does this look like? I mean, again, as someone who studies public opinion, I usually have a pretty good sense. I didn't exactly know what these numbers would look like. And I think the fact that it's 2/3 in favor is interesting. I think that it's more Republicans than Democrats is interesting. I think if we break it up and start to look at, like, well, what if we look at people who have kids versus not? It's going to be interesting. But nonetheless, I think, you know, this is the idea that there's a huge share of, you know, parents or otherwise out there sort of saying, no, these kids need to have cell phones in schools. Probably not. I think people should feel pretty safe at kind of pushing ahead with this in this policy domain.
Yeah. And I think they feel that way in the legislature right now.
They do.
You know, this has had a lot of momentum. So much as I appreciate Darren's invitation to talk about either pot or gambling.
Offline, Jim. Offline.
I want to go with something a little more mundane as far as, you know, and this is sort of just catching up in a lot of ways to something that we didn't have time to get to. But, you know, we've talked for many years about two things being very consistent in the poll. One, Cornyn's not great job approval numbers. And second, the reign of immigration and border security is the most important problem facing the state. So dominant among Republicans that it showed up in our overall numbers. And it's over, and it's been, you know, sort of that end has been coming for a while. I mean, as we were going through this data, you know, you notice at the top line, you know, when we ask people most important problem facing the state, 21% choose either immigration, border security, exactly the same share that chose economy and either inflation or prices. When you dig down, the most striking thing is, and we've got a graphic on the website that'll probably be pretty prominent by now, in which we look at the share broken down by party who choose immigration and border security as the most important problem facing the state. The share of Republicans who identified immigration or border security in that response declined this time for the sixth poll in a row.
And by how many points?
I'm cheating that a little bit because there's a couple where it's flat, but I'm going to cheat it anyway. It fell from 68% in February of 2024 to 35% in April. 33 points. That's just amazing. And we don't have a lot of examples of that, I think, in the poll. And, you know, we can talk about, I mean, what I find so provocative about it is it invites so many different kinds of explanations. Right. You know, the obvious competition for immigration and from inflation and prices and the economy, which started prior to Trump's presidency, but also the very fact of, you know, the fact that things are quiet on the border, you know, compared to where they were during the height of this. Now, when these numbers were consistent for a decade, they were a little bit immune to the fluctuations. I mean, we saw a little bit of,
but that, you know, was not tracking. But that wasn't Republicans, really. That was actually probably Democrats.
And now, the dislodging of immigration and border security, you know, in these salience batteries, and you see it in the other salience batteries that we have, I think is really amazing. And one of the things that has to have us asking a lot of questions about what we're looking forward to in the next year.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think it's pretty striking.
We're going to spend so much time on this, but I mean, I think the important part here is, I think, you know, based on if you've been listening to this podcast, the centrality in terms of the role that immigration, in particular border security, plays to state level politics and to sort of the set pieces of state officials, and to the extent that either, I mean, again, for whatever reason, whether it's because of decreased border crossings, whether it's because honestly, Daddy Trump is taking care of it now. Right. And we see it in other numbers in the poll, too, which we'll come back to. You know, it is going to be interesting to see what the adjustment looks like from Texas Republicans, who now all of a sudden, maybe this isn't the issue that you can just always talk about.
Right. And it's not that the issue is like dead in the water now. I mean, you know, Republicans' approval of Trump's handling of immigration and border security are the highest of the dozen issues we tested him on. I mean, 92% approved and only 4% disapproved.
But I think that's the thing, right? Is that so we see the decrease in MIP on Immigration Board, but we also see that in the context of super high evaluations of Trump's handling of Immigration Board, which, again, we talked about the trend in the economy. This is the highest he's been rated overall and by Republicans on immigration and the border. At the same time, we didn't talk about this, but we'll come back to this. The share of Republicans who want to see state spending on border security increase actually went down for the first time over the same period. We've usually in the neighborhood of 60% of Republicans are saying we need to see more spending on border security, more spending. And this has been over the period in which the state has spent significantly more on border security. Now we see this final pullback to maybe the state's spending about the right amount, and that's among Republicans. Again, that totally shakes up the politics here if that's the case. Like if Trump is successful, that shakes up a lot of what is sort of, you know, an easy thing, because one of the things that Democrats can't compete on is immigration and the border. Well, what if that's not the issue?
Yeah, if the economy is more salient, it's helpful. But the other thing, but it also, I mean, I would disagree a little bit, at least with the current diagnosis of a shakeup, because what's interesting about what is going on, and, you know, we haven't talked about the legislature right now, is the implications of that spending result you talked about. Because right now, both budgets have $6.5 billion. I've been a broken record about this, I know. But both of them have $6.5 billion for the next biennium, which is holding border spending steady. Right. And there's always been some speculation about whether some of that money was being parked there to help, that could be pulled to help maybe shore up or help, you know, grease a final deal on disagreements between mainly Republicans in the House and the Senate and involving Governor Abbott. But what this number tells me is that while the salience has gone down, I'm not sure people are going to feel comfortable enough yet coming out and being somebody that says, we decreased border security spending in Texas in the last cycle.
Yeah, just a quick point. The Republicans, we've used the metaphor of the dog that caught the car it's been chasing, and mostly with respect to abortion. And they turned abortion from, you know, rallying. It's tough to say this because it, normatively I think it sounds objectionable, and I hope people don't take it that way. But policy success sometimes doesn't help you politically. And, you know, we could talk about kind of the nature of coverage of the border and that shifted and, you know, confirmation bias. But honestly, this looks like an episode that, and so to be fair and bipartisan, it's kind of started in the last days of the Biden administration. But the problem, immediate problem on the border seems to have largely been, you know, kind of brought under control. So I'll split the difference between the two of you. I think the question in some ways shifts back to immigration, not entirely. As Jim said, there's this sort of money handling out there, money issues that are not going away. But if the issue becomes immigration, then we start talking about, well, due process to, you know, people who are non-citizens. We start talking about, you know, deferred action. We start talking about children who've been here, birthright citizenship.
So it gets real easy.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying it becomes a 50-50 issue, not a 90-10. And border security was a 90-10 favoring Republicans on in terms of spending and aggressive policy.
Yeah, right.
Immigration is 50-50. And, you know, so it's a net loser as the conversation shifts in that way. And I mean, you see this in the numbers, right? Which is the areas in which Trump has had success, according to the public, are, you know, immigration or border security and crime. And guess what? They're disappearing from the agenda. Not entirely, but...
Well, and I'd go a step further and say, if you look at the last poll we did, where we had a list of more particular immigration actions that were getting a lot of play from the early period of the Trump administration, the shift to immigration, I mean, you know, it seemed like the shift from the border, which had become quiet, to immigration enforcement was very purposive. But the way they did it was not entirely effective in building consensus.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah.
Guys, thanks.
Yeah, good times.
A lot of fun, as always. So thanks to both of you guys for being here. To our listeners, you will find all these poll results, documents, thousands of graphics, data sets, extensive discussion, pretty much everything you could want for your Texas Public Opinion Jones.
Probably more.
At texaspolitics.utexas.edu. I also want to mention, when you go to the website, you will see a link to a fundraising campaign that we are part of at the University of Texas called 40 for 40. Follow that link. It'll take you directly to a contribution link. We are looking to expand our hiring of undergraduates in particular to work on research. So you can, it's a very modern giving campaign. We're not asking you to, you know, sign away your estate. You can give as little as $5.
I would take an estate.
You can
though.
Give much more if you want. Yeah. You know, we are interested in whatever you're willing to help us commit to help support our work here at the University of Texas. So that's the 40 for 40 campaign. You'll see it on our website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. We'll also push some of that in social media. So I would respectfully ask you to consider some of your tax deductible with an asterisk dollars for our little enterprise here, as frankly, we look like we're heading into some tough times. Now, I don't want to go from poll writer to respondent here, but if somebody was asking me about the future, I'm not feeling optimistic. So, you know, if you could help us out, we'd appreciate that. With that, thanks as always to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts here at the University of Texas at Austin. And again, thank you for listening. Check out the new polling data, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.